Today's Teisho will be on case 66 in the Book of Serenity, Zhui Feng's Head and Tail. Introduction. Even those who subtly exercise spiritual powers cannot set a foot down. Even those who forget objects and end thought cannot raise a foot. As you might say, sometimes running to death, sometimes sitting to death. How can you attain proper timing? Case. A monk asked Zhui Feng, "What is the head?" Zhui Feng said, "Opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn." The monk asked, "What is the tail?" Zhui Feng said, "Not sitting on a 10,000-year seat." The monk said, "How is it when having a head but no tail?" Zhui Feng said, "After all, it's not precious." The monk said, "How about having a tail but no head?" Zhui Feng said, "Though full, no power." The monk said, "How about when you get the head and the tail in mutual harmony?" Zhui Feng said, "Descendants gain power. In the room, it's unknown." Verse. Round in a compass, square in a ruler. Used, it acts. Left, it's concealed. Stationary, the birds resting on the reeds. Going back and forth, the ram caught in the fence. Eating others' food, sleeping in one's own bed. Clouds spring up and make rain. Dew forms and turns into frost. The jade thread is pushed through the eye of the golden needle. Silk floss unceasingly spits from the shuttle's guts. The stone woman's loom stops. The color of night turns toward noon. The wooden man's road turns. The shadows of the moonlight have reached the center. I want to thank everyone for coming here to practice Zen this morning. Very wonderful sitting in this room. We had about 20-some people here just to start the day. And everybody was sitting very still. That first hour and a half went by like this. Nobody was moving. It was wonderful. Wonderful. That kind of practice is just thrilling. And then other people came in at 9:30, and again, two very long sits, no moving, beautiful, really excellent. I was reading an article yesterday on, it was a European journalist, who went to visit the Shaolin Temple on the mainland in China. Some of you may know the story of Dhammo, of Dharma, Bodhidharma, and how he came from India and met the Emperor of China, Emperor Wu of Liang. Unfortunately, the emperor didn't understand Zen, didn't understand this school of practice. And so Bodhidharma went away from the palace and went into the area of what is now a Shaolin temple. And he practiced sitting in a cave, practiced the Zazen sitting in a cave for 9 years. And eventually, two men and a woman came and became his students. Ultimately, a temple was founded, the Shaolin Temple. And this reporter had gone there to, because of its association with the martial arts, so-called, and he was really doing a story on, I guess, martial arts. But he got up with the monks, senior monks, around 3:30 in the morning, and he went in and sat with them. And he said they were at 3:30. They got up, and at 4 o'clock they all came in and sat down. And he said they started their prayers. Well, he didn't really understand, but this was sutra recitation. And he said it was quite beautiful. And if you've heard some of the recordings of Chinese monks and nuns, their sutras can be quite beautiful, actually, quite somewhat elaborate. So we do a pretty good job, but we don't get to practice together all the time. But they have a real harmony and a very, very beautiful sutras. So listen to those sutras, which he thought were prayers, and was very impressed by that. They did some chan, some zhou chan, some zazen together. And later he had a chance to talk to the abbot. And he said, you know, it was so beautiful sitting in the zendo this morning, and so peaceful and quiet, and so still. And then all of you went out and started doing your training, your martial arts. And he said, I don't understand how you can square your peaceful philosophy with these violent practice of martial arts. And the monk, abbot rather, said something very interesting. He said, you know, we don't practice like a kung fu. We don't practice our art for fighting. He said, that's not why we do it. He said we do it to harmonize ourselves with the world. And the reporter didn't really understand this, you know, but the monk tried to explain. He said that all the postures, all the movements in Shaolin Kung Fu originally came from watching animals. See, this is something you don't hear about necessarily, but he said all of these different movements came from observing animals, the motion of bears, snakes, a hawk. And he said, basically, we created these movements by watching animals, and when we do the movements, we're harmonizing ourselves with nature, with the Tao. And he said, it's really not about, it really didn't begin as a martial art. And he said, later, these abilities were used at a time when people were defenseless and had no weapons to help people who were defenseless. But it was interesting too that the abbot was invited to have the monks, the Shaolin monks, compete in the Olympics. And he said no, because he said, this isn't really about competition. I was so happy to see him say that. But you know, in the West, we don't necessarily think of the martial arts as having very little to do really with the beating somebody's brains out, you know. And really they're about harmonizing yourself with the world. And same thing is true for yoga, you know. Let me just say that yoga in America has been turned into something almost beyond recognition. That when you read about things like a Bikram yoga, where you get a hot room, and you, or power yoga, you know, really this was all of these different asanas came from trial and error, not observing animals, but experimenting with the relationship between body and mind. And so they're all a system for harmonizing ourselves with the world, with the reality or fundamental nature. And it's like a system where, basically people are very crude, can become very crude minded. Yeah, very crude minded. And eventually you might become unhappy with being so crude-minded, crude-spirited, you could say. And you might start doing yoga. And it's working with your body and your muscles and so on, but it's also working with your mind and the way you perceive the world, the way you experience the moment. And even if your motive is, even in the United States, where your motive might be to lose a few pounds or something like that, or to get in shape for the beach, you know. Eventually, if you keep doing this, it has a deeply transformative effect on you. And it's part of a system. But anyway, the reporter, at one point in his in this article on the Shaolin Temple, was very moved by the way they lived, and he said, you know, as I was sitting there in the morning at 4:30 in the morning, listening to the monks recite their sutras, I realized that people had been doing this since the fall of the Roman Empire in this very room. Now, every morning, people have been getting up since 375 in the Common Era and reciting sutras and doing zazen in that room continuously. Now, maybe that impresses you and maybe it doesn't, but I thought it was kind of neat. And, we're not in Shaolin Temple, but we all got up this morning to do this practice, this beautiful practice, and we're engaged in the same energy, same effort, same way of life as those monks who have been sitting there for 1700 years. When my teacher went to China with his teacher, they visited a number of temples in China, and a lot of Chinese temples have signs above the door that say something about practice or. So you might see a temple where they have the characters for calm the waves, meaning calm your mind. That's a common one, calm the waves. But this temple had four characters, and my teacher told me they mean deep sitting makes people not crude-spirited. Deep sitting makes people not crude-spirited. So, if you went home last night and you turned on the news, or you turned on TV, and or you, you know, basically you looked at the paper from, or maybe you went online and, you know, you might have watched a movie where somebody shoots somebody or, you know, there's maybe somebody steals a bunch of money and gets away with it, and there's a lot of booze and a lot of gunfights and so on and so on. And then you know, you read the newspaper and you read about the slimy politicians, you know, and what they're doing and how they're, you know, embarrassing one another or how they're spreading lies about each other and so on and so on. It's easy to become like crude spirited, you know. So you find yourself becoming angry, you know, cynical, bitter. You know, those are common emotions. Anger, cynicism, bitterness, disappointment. You know, those are like very common emotions, and they're sort of like a sign that we're crude-spirited, you know. So coming into practice is just, I think, a wonderful way to live, because there's a lot in our society that makes us crude-spirited. I'm always amazed by the fact that some of the most powerful people in the world are really, you know, quite horrific people, you know. So some of you might have followed apparently I too read the papers, you know. That's why I have to do an equal amount of zazen to equal the papers. So I was at some time ago I was reading about John McCain, who could be the next president. And apparently at one point he had made a joke about launching an offensive on Iran. And in America we have a song that it's called Barbara Ann by the Beach Boys. And they say her name very fast, Bob, 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 Barbara Ann. Right? And McCain had said, bomb, 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 Iran. And it's funny, you know, but it's funny like a cartoon where somebody blows somebody's head off with a shotgun and then their head pops up from between their shoulders. It's funny in kind of a gruesome, really terrifying way. It's funny because our culture isn't healthy, right? And I mean, I laughed too when I read it. I thought, you know, that's clever, you know. But when you think about it, only a very unhealthy culture would find that funny, you know. And I also read how Mrs. Clinton was talking about obliterating Iran again. And I was just stunned, you know, because and these people could be in charge of the country. And you see other kinds of evidence that people are quite crude-spirited, right? Crude-spirited. And these are the people who are quote-unquote normal and even preeminent. When I was in graduate school, I had a professor. There was a professor I liked a lot. His name was Gary. And he became my dissertation advisor, so I was taking graduate courses. And there was one man I met in all of these professors I had who really stood out for me. He was very, I really felt admiration for him. And he seemed like a very cultured person, you know, a very cultivated person. He was like a Shakespearean scholar and sort of Renaissance person, you know. He was very, I knew his wife, she was a very nice person, and I really admired him a great deal. And he was very cultured, you know. I came from a family that wasn't very cultured. You know, I came from like a beer family. And he was like a wine person, right, you know. So that kind of thing, you know. My family didn't have that many books in the house, you know. And my mother once took a trip. She took a trip up to Washington, D.C., when the Mona Lisa, Leonardo's famous painting, was there. And, you know, she bought a photo reproduction of the Mona Lisa, and she had it framed in a very expensive frame and put over our fireplace, you know. So people thought maybe we had the Mona Lisa, I guess, you know. You know, some people, it's charming, right? But my mother even had the photo. They can actually put like paraffin on the photo to make it look like a real oil painting, you know. She had that done, so we had like the Mona Lisa in our living room. And that was the one time my mother had ever been to a gallery, you know. So when I met Gary Cox, you know, he knew art, he knew Italian, he knew French, he was very urbane, he drank wine, you know. And he could just sit there and go, oh, as Shakespeare says, blah, 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 you know. And I thought, oh my gosh, how wonderful, you know. So I became his student. And he was a good director, but I didn't see the whole person, you know. And eventually, his wife got a job at Cornell, and he went out to Cornell with her. And when he was at Cornell, he wasn't a very good director for my dissertation. I couldn't get him to respond to my letters, or I'd send him a chapter and he wouldn't read it. And finally I asked my, I was getting nowhere with my dissertation, you know. And I went to the graduate director and I said, listen, I can't get Gary Cox to read my dissertation. And the guy said, well, look, why don't you reconstitute your committee and get a new head of the committee, somebody who will take charge. So I asked this other professor, Eric LaGuardia was his name, to be my new chair. And my Gary Cox, my first dissertation director, when he heard about this, he wrote me this incredibly unpleasant letter. And he said, you're just asking Eric to be the director because he's more famous than I am. You know? And it was just like really hurtful letter, you know, like what a brown noser I am, and that kind of thing. How ungrateful I was, and so on. And all I wanted to do was get my dissertation done. I really didn't have an ulterior motive. But seeing this letter from him, it just shattered my dream. But then I began to put it into perspective, and it wasn't like all the things I admired about him were false, you know. It's just that he too was crude spirited, you know. So there's a lot of crude spiritedness out there, and people are very naive, I think, about this fact, until you know, there's some kind of explosion. Recently in Africa, we've had some political unrest because of an election, and people have actually gotten killed, lots of people. When this kind of thing happens, you suddenly realize that right under the surface there's all this turmoil, you know. So it's wonderful when people come in here and purify body, heart, and mind, as all of you are doing today. Very, very important, I think. Now, one way to understand this koan, this is a Zhui Feng's head and tail. You probably have a hard time making any sense out of this koan, which is what it was designed to, that's the effect it was designed to have on you. But basically, if you buy this idea that you're coming in here to purify body, heart, and mind, and you buy this idea that people do get very crude spirited, to put it nicely, and that this is really important, you probably have had a good experience on the cushion. You know, you come in and you sit on the cushion, and you watch your breath, and you do get a little calmer, right? And you feel probably a little better. And at some point, you have a little bit of relief. You can go through the day a little more calmly, a little more patience. And you might wonder, well, you know, where does this end? Where does this process end? Or where is it going to stop? You know. Another way to put it would be, okay, I got up this morning to come to sit. You know, but how many more mornings am I going to have to do this? If you sit on the cushion long enough, you're going to begin to have experiences that I'm sure many of you have had, where you begin to feel like parts of your body are disappearing. You know, so if you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, at first, your mind is just like a beehive of thoughts. Beehive of thoughts. And you're pulled this way and that way and so on. But eventually, you know, if you keep focusing on your breath, you begin to have the experience, which is quite beautiful. And typically, people feel like their hands or their face are disappearing, or like they're floating or expanding. And this feeling is usually accompanied by these sensations, I should say, are usually accompanied by like this feeling of great well-being, or even like bliss. Maybe some of you have had that. Where I will talk to people after the sit, and I'll say, "How was your sit?" And every once in a while, somebody's had one of these sits where they enter what we call deep samadhi, you know, and it's like bliss. It's really beautiful. And I'll say, "How was your sit?" And I'll say, "Wow, that was fantastic." And you feel this deep sense of well-being, this deep sense of like being home. Yeah. If you haven't had that experience yet, please keep sitting, because it will happen to you. And it can take a while. I mean, I don't think I had a dramatic samadhi experience for a number of years into my practice. I had like a feeling of well-being. When I'd get off the cushion, I was not so frightened or angry. But generally, it takes people maybe 3 to 6 months to start having an occasional samadhi experience. And if you keep practicing, you begin to have them more often. Now, the interesting thing is that these samadhi experiences can become a little bit addicting, because that feeling of peace and well-being is very, very beautiful. And in fact, in some traditions, some meditation traditions, what samadhi is like considered to be it. You know, like that's it. In our tradition, we say, actually, no, that's the beginning of something, not the end. And so you kind of have to have a teacher who will say to you, listen, you can't stay there. You have to go on to the next koan, which is the mu koan. A person came in to see me some time ago, and he was telling me how he was having these beautiful sits. And he told me that he didn't like to come here and sit in this room because the fan made too much noise. He said, when I'm at home, he said, it's very quiet. I can't hear anything. And I enter this beautiful state. And he said, I can't do that here because the fan distracts me. And he actually said, can you turn that fan off? And I first of all explained that the fan is really good because it blocks out all the other noise. But I also said, you know, you're really becoming addicted to samadhi. And he's a very nice guy, but he did look a little nervous, you know, because people get attached to that. So basically, people have to watch the breath a little more carefully, and you notice that your mind begins to have intervals where it goes blank or dark. And you have to spend a fairly long time in this state, like years, if you want to practice Zen seriously. And eventually you have like a psychological breakthrough. It's like normally the small mind, the personal mind, is you know, rather closed off from the big mind. So we have a kind of a big mind, deep unconscious processor. But we live in our little self, in our conscious mind. And when you work with the mu koan, with that emptiness long enough, you have like an opening. And it's like a big mind enters little mind for the first time. Usually this is accompanied by like a kind of a powerful energy, feeling of like powerful energy. Yeah? And this is like the second stage, you could say, in Zen practice. First stage is entering samadhi. Second stage is having this breakthrough into big mind. And then a lot of practice after that involves continuing that opening up process by working on our obstacles, because they are inner obstacles that prevent us from experiencing the world as it really is. You know? One of the good things about living in a world like this is that we have a powerful motivation to practice, I believe. You know, in ancient times, this was true in a different way, you know. So, you know, I think in ancient times, people were constantly surrounded by sickness, death, and privation, you know. I think that was just constant. You know, imagine a world without like dentists, doctors, and you know, a grocery store system. You know? A friend of mine, I actually met this Tibetan teacher, and his name was Geshe Darge, and he was actually the Dalai Lama wanted to know about sutras, he asked Geshe Darge, because Darge was like the very distinguished scholar in the Tibetan community. A friend of mine introduced me to him. And one of the things that he was amazed about was grocery stores. You know, because in Tibet there was never enough food. And when he went to a first time, he went to an American grocery store. He came from like Dharamsala and went to like Safeway. You know? It was astounding to him, like a million oranges, you know, a million apples, you know, pineapples, papaya. You know, he just it was almost like he went into shock. You know? Because like the constant for people for thousands of years was like never enough food, always sick, right? That's how it was. You know, people didn't live very long. You know, at various points in history, you know, people lived to be 39, 40. Even in the United States. You know, like a person who was 50 years old 100 years ago was really old and used up. You know, and now, I mean, a person who's 55 can be very youthful, in my opinion. And, you know, imagine your teeth are falling out, you have to pull them out, you know, you're always sick. And this was how people sort of were induced to practice, right? You know, it's like this is like a very crude pressure, right? You know, physical pain, hunger, and some people were pushed onto the cushion because of that. You know, in our world, it's very different, right? We're not hungry. Many of us can get decent medical care. I wish everybody could. And I hope that will be taken care of soon. You know, we have other kinds of experiences of unhappiness, other sources of unhappiness, like pressure. And people are mostly engaged in a struggle for self-esteem, you know, really, which is what money is all about, too. And so people are constantly under pressure to achieve something they want to achieve or be something they want to be, and they're constantly disappointed and threatened and unhappy. So we come to the cushion, you know, this process of Zen is I think wonderful because it really does provide relief. It's really like medicine. And most of us have powerful psychological motivations for doing this. You know, we're unhappiness, maybe not, you know, illness, although some people have illnesses, you know. But usually it's some psychological motivation. We're unhappy, we're uncertain, you know, these sort of modern problems. And for me, you know, I was very insecure, fearful, and unhappy person when I started doing Zen. I really did feel like I was a house on fire. You know, there's a famous sutra by the Buddha where he says, you know, basically, this world is on fire. And it's impermanent and unsatisfying, is what he said. And I felt like that. You know, I felt like my life was on fire. I was just so unhappy. I felt so ill at ease in the world. That no harmony, you know. And so when I started practicing Zen, it was so cooling and liberating, and it took away this terrible sense of pressure, this fear of failure, of falling, you know, and many other fears, you know. And it was like this constant infusion of medicine. And so I just kept practicing because I my misery was pushing me forward, and the relief I got from Zen was sort of pulling me forward, you know. I think that's a good situation, believe it or not. You know, I really do. And so, you know, you work through many, many barriers in life. If you keep going, I promise you, you won't be disappointed. It's really quite wonderful. And at some point, you know, people have this experience which is called Daikensho, you know, like a great awakening experience. Now, some of you have come to Sesshin, and you know how wonderful it is at Sesshin, probably everybody who's been to Sashin has had a Kensho experience. This is where, you know, normally we're in our little mind and we're fearful or angry or whatever, crude spirited. And after 3 days of Sashin, the mind begins to become calm and open. And we can have an experience of like things as they are. You know, fundamental reality, something like that. It's like your fears and your anxieties, your conceptual structures fall away, and you can have this experience of reality. So it's like an opening up. It's the world as experienced with your whole being. Yeah? It's a little mind and big mind. It's a unified mind in accord with the way. That's what Saint San calls it. And then it closes up. Yeah? And then you come home from Sashin and you're back in the mess and you feel like you're going crazy again. Yeah. Then you come to another Sashin and it opens up and it closes up again, you know. And this goes on and on for years, for as long as you want to go, you know. And if you go, if you're diligent enough and you're determined enough, sooner or later people have like a really powerful, decisive opening up. And after that, you have a different relationship to your life, I would say. When you first practice, when you first start practicing, it's like this. It's like you are Kurt, or you are Bill, and you know you have all of Kurt's problems, right? And they can be, you know, pressure to get tenure, or whatever, you know. Paying some bills, not being lovable, you know, whatever. My father never really liked me, you know, whatever. And every once in a while you sort of slip into big mind, right? It's like you slip into big mind. And then you're out of it, you know? So you come in, you sit on the cushion, it's like, oh, geez, you know, will I get into medical school, you know, what's going to become of me? You know, will I be digging ditches? My father always used to say, if you don't do this, you're going to dig ditches. So, you know, even now, you know, it's like digging ditches. Oh my God, you know. And as I say, I dug ditches, you know, actually. I had a construction job, and the guy actually said, here, dig these ditches, you know. And I dug them, and I thought, this isn't so bad, but, you know, the fear is still there, right? So you sit on the cushion and you think, oh God, I'm so afraid, I'm so afraid, or I'm so mad, or I'm so disappointed, I'm blah, 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 you know. And then, you know, you have these moments where it's just like, oh, it's like a clearing. You realize this is not so important. But then it closes up again, you know. This goes on and on. If you want to go on and on, it's not a bad process because, you know, when it does open up, you feel better, right? But then, you know, if you wanted to say, well, what's Dai Kensho like? It has many dimensions, but one of the things that it's like is this. It's like, after that, you stop looking at yourself that way. It's like your home base is no longer Kurt. It's like your home base is big mind, and Kurt is like a place you go to when you're with other people. That's very much how it is. You know, it's like, oh yes, you know. It's like wearing a uniform. This is your Kurt uniform. Or this is your Bill uniform that you put on and you go to your job, right? And then you come home and you can just be nobody, which is actually quite beautiful, right? You could just be the universe. And even people who have had Dai Kensho still, you know, sometimes take their little self a little too seriously. But it's not like where you spend all your time. You spend all your time like with your, spend a lot of your time with your true nature. Now, another way to put it is like this, you know. For part of our lives, if you're as Zen as your life, for part of your life, what you're really interested in is fixing up your room, you know? And you want to make sure it's a nice room. You know, you can go to the store and you can get books on, Metropolitan Home. You know, when I'm in the grocery line, I'll read Metropolitan Home. And it's like having a cool, hip house, you know? There's even a magazine now that's called Real Simple, which I saw in the grocery store. It's called Real Simple. It's about living a simple lifestyle, but if you read it, it's just like all the others, because it's full of junk you can buy, right? You know. But we're under tremendous pressure, right, to have the right house. You know, it's got to be in the right neighborhood. It has to have the right look. I'm not just talking about a house, of course, but our room. You know, it's got to have the right furniture in it. It's got to have tasteful objects from Asia, you know, a Buddha head here, you know, a nice book here, you know, a painting here, not the Mona Lisa, that's not hip, right? Has to be something cool, you know, my mother was not cool, you know, so you want to have a nice room, right? But it's very important to get the right room, but you know, at some point, if you keep practicing, you realize this is just like a hotel room. You know, I'm just here, this is just this room for today, right? I'm just staying in this room for a little while. It's not that important. And I think that's a wonderful, personally, that's a beautiful way to live, in my opinion. It's not, naturally you should respect yourself, you know. Naturally you should take a shower, you know, brush your teeth, do your best at work. But it's you have a different relationship to these things. I mean, that's not all there is to Daikensho. But it's a different relationship to your little self, you know. And it's, I must say, it's so liberating. You know, when I was in graduate school, I was so stressed out all the time. I felt like such a moron, you know, a lot of the time. I've talked about this before. I would go to graduate classes, and these people were so learned. You know, there were guys who spoke three or four languages, and they would tell jokes in other languages, you know. You know, I could hardly get the joke in English, you know. The jokes were so clever, even in English I couldn't understand them. And I'm not an idiot, I know that. But I felt like an idiot, you know, a lot of the time. And I would write these graduate papers, and my professors would, you know. And then you have to go publish, you have to try to publish, and you get rejection slips, you know. You get these, they're saying, if you want to get a job, you must get something published. So you think, oh my God, I've got to get something published. So you write it up, you send it out, and you get a rejection. Ah! I'll never get a job, right? If I don't get a job, what's going to happen? Digging ditches. So you write another article, you know, send it out. Rejection! Ah! You know, and sometimes rejections are very biting. You know, academics are not all nice people. In case you haven't met any, you might still have that illusion. But, you know, the thing might say, only an idiot could have written this article. You know, I wouldn't quite say that. But the humanities, they can be very nasty. You know, they can be very sort of sly and unpleasant. So this, you know, I don't see how any intelligent person could have made this argument, so on. So, oh my God. So this is going on, right, you know. And it's heartbreaking and it's scary, right. And I used to lie in bed at night. And I have to tell you the truth, I had like, you know, fantasies of oblivion, right? I would think, okay, I'm going to tie like bags of sand to my feet and row out into Lake Washington and just go over the boat, you know? Really, I used to have these fantasies, like suicide fantasies. I wasn't going to kill myself, you know? But it felt so comforting, right? I thought if I had a boat, and I had the sand in the bags, and I went out. Nobody would know I killed myself, you know, and I just row out into Lake Washington, which was right near my house. You know, somehow I had a boat and the bags of sand or whatever I'd tie. And I just dropped, and I would just see myself like going over the edge of the boat into the black water, sinking down, right? And down there in the bottom of Lake Washington, nobody could see what a failure I was, see? So it was so reassuring, and then I would drift off to sleep, right? And I'd get up the next day and go to my graduate class or whatever, you know. But that fantasy, just like sink down into oblivion and no longer exist, was so comforting, you know, because I had so much pressure. And I think a lot of people feel that way. You know, they think, I can't wait to get through this life. I can't wait to get over this whole thing, to be done with this, you know. I think that's such a great pity. You know, I'm so glad I don't live that way anymore. But it's very, I think, human, you know, to the pressures, the disappointments, you know. It's just like, let me out of here. I just want to be, I don't want to exist anymore, you know. But, you know, if you can just keep practicing long enough, if you spend enough time in Big Mind, you know, you realize that, you know, your little self isn't your life. It's everything is your life, you know. And, you know, in a certain sense, well, reincarnation might not make any sense. And indeed, it might just be a fantasy, right? On a certain level. But on another level, it's absolutely true, right? And that life just goes on and on, you know? And it never dies. You know, even if this, you know, that physicists say now, you know, that when this universe, you know, goes, there's just going to be another universe. They really believe that. In fact, they even think that universes come out of black holes, right? So right now there's baby universes coming out of black holes all over the universe, you know, so we don't even have a word for it anymore. It's like there's infinite numbers of universes, maybe, all coming out of these black holes and so on and so on. It's like life goes on forever, right? Now, if you live in your small self, you know, you think, okay, born 1953, died whenever, right? Can't wait till it's over, right? Can't wait till I'm safe, right? I'm safe. Finally, I'm going to be dead. I'll be in my coffin or whatever, and nothing can hurt me anymore. You know, what a relief, right? And then I'll, you know, basically be in heaven or whatever. And I think that's a great pity, but I myself lived that way psychologically for a long time. But, you know, you get outside of your big self, you realize, like, you know, this whole thing that's going on and all these black holes, you know, this is my true nature. You know, this is my true self. You know, it's like deathless life, right? And for some people, the idea that life is going to go on eternally and we're going to be part of it is like a nightmare, right? It's like a nightmare of sitting in graduate class and not knowing German, right? You know, and being humiliated. Right? Eternity like that, right? You know, but you know, if you get outside of your little self and you begin to participate in the life of the universe, after a while, like, living forever is actually a very beautiful idea if you love to be alive, you know? And that's what this is all about. It's like loving to be alive, like unconditionally, you know? And the truth is, you aren't just your small self. You know, intellectually, you know you're part of the universe. You are. Right? But we don't live at that level often. And Zen is about living at that level. You know, so you know, whether I get a promotion, whether I get my next article published, This is my motel room self. And it's important to keep your room clean, right? Magazines stacked up over here, you know, make the bed. But you have a bigger life. And it's wonderful to live that life. You know, it's like a deathless life. So that's the head and the tail. See, that's the head and the tail. case you were wondering what this crazy koan was all about. A monk asked Zhuifeng, "What is the head?" Zhuifeng said, "Opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn." Please don't try to think this out, right? Just go with the flow. A monk asked, "What is the tail?" Zhuifeng said, "Not sitting on a 10,000-year seat." The monk said, "How is it when having a head but no tail?" Zhuifeng said, "After all, it's not precious." The monk said, "How about having a tail and no head?" Zhuifeng said, "Though full, no power." The monk said, "How about when you get the head and the tail in mutual harmony? Endless life. Let's be part of endless life." See, if that's this, that's Zen. Let's be part of endless life. See, are you ready? Are you ready? Let's do it. Let's do it. It's wonderful. Zhuifeng said, "Descendants gain power. In the room it's on, no. And let's live this endless life. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth. Wonderful." Round in a compass, what is it? It's round when it's round, and it's square when it's square. Used, it's useful. Not used, it's concealed. Stationary, sometimes it's stationary, and the birds rest on the reeds. Sometimes it goes back and forth, like a ram caught in a fence. Eating others' food, sleeping in one's own bed. Clouds spring up and make rain, dew forms and turns into frost. The jade thread is pushed through the eye of the golden needle. Silk floss unceasingly spits from the shuttle's guts. The stone woman's loom stops. Color of night turns toward moon. The wooden man's road turns. The shadow of the moon, the shadows of the moonlight have reached the center. It's just like this endless life, endless life.